This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we all have something to worry about, at least at some point in our lives, but sometimes we worry too much for our own good. A psychologist shares advice on how to manage our worrying habits. Now, Wisconsin's Republican-controlled legislature is moving forward with a proposed amendment to the state constitution that would change the state's cash bail system. If approved by lawmakers this session, the proposal would then go to voters. It could end up on the April 4th ballot. Supporters say the proposed amendment would allow judges to consider more info about the accused when setting their bail. Opponents argue this would, in effect, penalize poor people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, would you want to see when it comes to Wisconsin's cash bail system and changes? Do you like this idea that would allow judges to consider more factors, possible risk factors when setting that cash bail amount? Or do we need something other than cash bail to take those kind of safety measures? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ian Main is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School in Madison. He's the principal author of the American Bar Association's Divergence Standards. These new standards were adopted last summer. They provide guidance when considering alternatives to traditional criminal justice system outcomes. Ian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Can you talk us through the current state of affairs when we're assessing bail? What can we, what can't we consider?
Yeah, in Wisconsin, it's called a cash-based model, and that's opposed to a risk-based model. And regardless of what model is being used, and different models are used in different states, it doesn't matter in terms of what the state's objectives are. And the state's objectives, regardless of the state that you're in, will be two things. One, that if someone is released while they're awaiting trial, that's after they've been arrested, say, that they're going to appear for any court hearings. And number two, that while they are released, the community is safe. Those are the two chief justifications, and those are universal, regardless of what state you're in. And states do different things to achieve those objectives. The objective of making defendant sure that defendant appears, and two, that while released, that person acts within the community so the community is not harmed. So Wisconsin has a cash-based model. It uses cash as a tool to try to achieve those objectives, to make someone appear and to keep the community safe. Other jurisdictions are called risk-based models. And in a risk-based model, there's no cash involved in trying to achieve the objective of ensuring that the defendant appears and that the community is safe. Instead, used to determine whether or not a person should be released, and if so, what conditions should attach, the jurisdictions look at what are called actuarial risk tables or risk assessment tools to determine whether someone is low or moderate or high risk. And depending on that kind of outcome, the jurisdiction will generally release that person with conditions that are appropriate to ensure that person appears or that the community is safe. Again, Wisconsin doesn't use that model. Instead, Wisconsin uses cash as a tool to achieve those things.
As you see this proposal for a change to the state's constitution, what would change in effect when it comes to bail?
I don't want to be flippant here, but I'm going to be a little flippant, and then maybe a more nuanced discussion can follow. So the flippant and possibly accurate response to that question is, if this amendment passes to the Constitution, what change will occur? The answer is nothing. I'm happy, you know, to discuss the nuances, but that's really the response, is
sure.
Nothing. Nothing changes.
Right. Well, the idea is we're going to allow judges to consider more risk factors in setting the dollar amount of cash bail. Why in practice do you see that as not effectively changing anything?
Yeah, in practice, that's already considered by judges. I mean, I served as a defense attorney in this kind of situation, and dangerousness and risk to others and community safety is an integral part of discussions that lead to whether or not there's going to be cash bail and to the amount of that cash bail.
We are talking about a proposed constitutional amendment to Wisconsin's cash bail system. Ian Main is with us from the UW Law School. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Madeline is with us in De Pere. Madeline, hi.
Hello. I really don't believe in cash bail for people who have demonstrated that they're willing to do physical harm to other people. I'm not just talking about people who shoot their mouth off and say stupid stuff that they shouldn't say, but who have actually, if they've actually demonstrated that they, you know, are willing to do that, like, especially if they have a gun, I don't think they should be outed. They use cash bail for a flight risk. Well, that should be not considered at all if those people are really dangerous.
Madeline, thanks for the call. That's that risk-based model. As you said, Ian, not what we do here in Wisconsin, but other states do that. Can you talk about the pros and cons of that kind of assessment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, these distinctions are important, and I appreciate the caller's concerns, and those concerns are shared by a lot of people, and understandably so. As we would all agree, I think, that we want the community to be safe as someone, if they are released or released. If they are truly dangerous, and there's various ways that jurisdictions determine if someone is dangerous, and there is a likelihood that if released, this person will engage in behavior that leads to, say, bodily or serious bodily harm or worse, as in the case of, say, Daryl Brooks, mm-hmm. There are in either system, Wisconsin system, whether it's cash bail or risk-based model, in both models, there are going to be rules that permit, under certain circumstances, a judge in the state to detain a person. They will not release that person. They will detain that person through trial. And so whether or not you're in a cash-based model like Wisconsin or you're in a risk-based model in a place like, say, Washington, D.C., both jurisdictions, if there is recognizably a real danger posed by an individual, there are ways to request that that person be detained in a bail system without bail, just detained, and in a risk-based model, just detained. Both situations, it would end up with the same result.
Madeline, thanks for that call. If I'm in this position, I've been accused of a violent crime, I'm being detained until my trial, could I have an argument that says, well, wait, I've been accused of a violent crime. I have a presumption of innocence, but I'm effectively being punished while I'm waiting for my trial. When do we run into that?
I mean, you can run into that. I mean, if you've actually committed a serious violent crime, and I don't know what you have in mind, and I think this is actually a really important point, because when we're discussing these types of things, we have to kind of, and many people have to start with what is the criminal system doing? What kind of types of crimes are being committed? If we look at just felonies, which is actually a real minority number of arrests that are made, are mostly misdemeanors. But if we look at just felonies, of all felonies, 1.7% involve a homicide or a sexual assault, first-degree sexual assault. So the first point being, like, if you say violent crime, and this is back at you just so that we can continue this conversation in a way that I respond to your question and to the concern of others, is what do you mean by a violent crime?
Well, let's say, I mean, hopefully we never end up here, but let's say it's a homicide, but I'm saying I didn't do it. I'm innocent, so why can you punish me in the meantime while I'm waiting for this trial?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so wrongful convictions is always a real concern. And in fact, the state's objectives, understandably, that you would appear and that the community is safe, is certainly on high alert if someone has allegedly committed a homicide. Now, in this situation of, say, Daryl Brooks, Daryl Brooks could argue all day long that he's presumed innocent, and there's not a person in the United States that thinks he is, right? And courts and prosecutors and defense attorneys are aware of these differences. There are some individuals where It's based on a really shaky eyewitness. It really may be someone who is innocent, absolutely. And if we detain that person, not only are we detaining someone who is not dangerous, but wrongly accused of a serious crime, but in addition to that, we are making it very hard for that person, however innocent, to defend themselves, because it's very hard to interface with an attorney and to be involved in an investigation. And your involvement is very important as a defendant in terms of the quality and outcome of any case. It absolutely would be diminished. And so your question gets to the discretionary aspect. And criminal justice stakeholders, including the judge, including the defense attorney, including the prosecutor and pretrial services, will all kind of make contributions to understanding the particular situation and that are unique, the circumstances that are unique to a particular case.
We're talking Ian Main, associate professor at UW's law school, looking at a proposed constitutional amendment that would expand the factors that a judge can consider when setting bail for someone accused of a crime. If it gets approved in the legislature again, we could be voting on this in early April. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ian Main, associate professor at the UW Law School. We're looking at the state legislature's push for a constitutional amendment to change Wisconsin's cash bail system. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Do you think this is a good idea? Are there changes, different changes maybe you would like to see made? Call 800-642-1234. Want to give a listen to arguments from each party in the legislature. First, Republican State Senator Van Wongard at this week's legislative hearing explaining what he says makes Wisconsin's rules for cash bail unique.
In 2021, of the 117 people charged with homicide in Milwaukee, a whopping 21% were committed by persons on bail. In fact, in national conversations, Wisconsin is held out as an example of what not to do when it comes to bail. Wisconsin is the only state that allows judges to consider only a single factor, whether or not a person will return to trial when setting cash bail.
Ian, your reaction?
That's true under the law. What happens in the trenches has no bearing on the truth.
All right, now let's give a listen to Democratic State Senator Chris Larson, who challenged the connection between a person's wealth and their risk to public safety.
If we are going to reform the system, instead we're galvanizing it in the state constitution to say money is moral. The more money you have, the more moral you're likely to be, the more likely we are judges to be able to say we're going to let you out. Why are we not saying if somebody's a risk, it doesn't matter how much money you have, you're a risk.
And your thoughts on that, Ian?
That is more in line with the thinking of a lot of states who are moving or considering moving to a risk-based model. And, as to be expected, I think the debate, and those are just two snippets, and I'm sure there's moments when it gets hopefully more comprehensive and considers empirical work that really should be informing bail reform. It's not going to happen with the question that's posed for the April ballot, but I think, I would encourage your listeners, and I would encourage, legislatures and people thinking about this, what the empirical studies show. And the empirical studies show that detention itself is criminogenic, that detention itself poses a risk to community safety. This is empirical studies, and it's been going on in the last 5 years. So it's actually new research, and it's important research. And so when you look at low to moderate risk folks who are still, for example, in Wisconsin, being held, 25% of those held in the Milwaukee jail in 2010 were sitting on low risk individuals and moderate risk individuals who were sitting on bail amounts of $500 or less that they could not pay. The empirical studies show that as to that group of individuals that we have detained pretrial, we are significantly increasing harm to our communities. We are undermining public safety. That's the type of discussions we should be having. I understand the first legislator's point, legislator's point about concerns about letting those who have committed a homicide released, whether it's on bail or not. And that's the question that the second representative was asked. Why are they being released at all? That's a good question. But these questions are not getting at real. So I should say there's an additional and arguably just as or more important question to be considering. And what are our current policies? How can they be improved so that in the vast majority of cases that are really creating community harm, can they be alleviated by reducing detention of low and moderate risk individuals? That should be a discussion that's raised and brought up by the legislature.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. The speaker indicates that there's really, from a practical standpoint, little difference between the risk and the cash-based bond system. Yet I hear people against the risk-based system say that certain elements of the population will be affected more by that. What's the basis of that argument?
That's a great question. And there are problems. And those problems actually don't go away with the cash-based model. But to directly respond to that question, which I think is great, is that the risk assessment tools themselves are biased and show bias to be against and be more harsh as to populations of color. So that if you're a person who's arrested and you're a person of color, statistically, your risk profile is higher because of your race. Keep in mind, and that is a serious consideration and concern, and it's something that many policymakers are working to improve. But keep in mind with the cash-based model, that is also at play. Cash amounts are higher for individuals of color in any system. And so those kinds of biases are going to be in either model. What's interesting about the risk-based model is that bias can be measured. And by being measured, it can be subtracted from those assessments. It's still a problem, and I'm glad the caller raised it. And it's a problem with both models.
Do you see ways, and thanks for that call, Dick, do you see ways to unbias either model to take that, in effect, the algorithm that goes into risk assessments and take some of the racial bias out of it?
Yeah, there is a way to do that, and it's possible to do that. You can't take it all out. You can't. And you can't take it out of the discretionary decision in the cash-based model system when you have a judge looking at a person of color and however unconscious the bias, creating a more severe set of conditions or possibly a higher bail amount in order to get pretrial release. On the risk-based model, you can, in a jurisdiction, show on average between similarly situated, say, black individuals versus white individuals, a differential. And that differential then can be subtracted from any individual's risk profile. So that it can be mitigated probably more in a risk-based model than in a cash-based model. But it's going to be part of the system regardless of what model.
Thanks for that call, Dick. We're talking to Ian Main from the UW Law School looking at a proposed state constitutional amendment on the cash bail system. Back to your calls. Glenn is with us in Madison. Glenn, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Doctor, can you explain why this is a constitutional amendment rather than a statutory change?
Why is that, Ian?
It's a good question. I think because the Constitution right now limits the consideration of bail, the money part, the cash part, to whether or not this person can be incentivized to appear. The question in the Constitution is the Constitution doesn't permit other factors. And so by creating a constitutional amendment that would then allow a judge to consider in particular circumstances in setting the cash bail amount, factors that are in addition to the question about whether this person is going to appear, for example, the dangerousness to the community, that's the type of change that's being made. If you make that change statutorily, you would run aground with the Constitution right now. And so there would be a mismatch between the statute right now if you try to expand the factors and what the Constitution says right now in Wisconsin. Again, I do want to state plainly, though, that in practice right now, that's what judges are doing anyway.
Thanks again for that call, Glenn. Ian, in just our last minute and a half or so, part of the story here, I understand over the years we've had issues with backlogs in courts, a long waiting time maybe between that initial arrest and court appearance and the actual trial. Is that a factor here? Because it determines how long you're going to be either incarcerated in jail, in effect, because you can't pay bail or out on bail.
It's a huge, huge, huge issue. And the fact that when someone's arrested, they spend time in jail, regardless of whether they're going to be released or not on bail, if that gets your question. And that itself does have a whole host of issues. It does affect really the bail amount. And that's for another possibly future discussion. It also has a criminogenic effect. And so jurisdictions might consider that there are a number of kind of offenses that instead of arresting someone and placing them in jail, which again is criminogenic and does create its own set of problems, that they're given a citation and a requirement that they show up for a court hearing in their criminal proceedings.
Ian, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
That's Ian Main, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School in Madison. He joined us today for a look at the state legislature's constitutional amendment proposal aimed at changing the way Wisconsin's cash bail system works. You can keep sharing your thoughts on that. Email ideas@WPR.org and then watch for your ballots come the April election. Good chance that this amendment will go to voters then if approved by a second round of votes in the state legislature. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the raw milk debate in Wisconsin goes on and on. Find out why some farmers and consumers are making the case for unpasteurized dairy in spite of health concerns that have been raised over the years, and where the state of state laws stands right now. You can share your thoughts. Are you a fan of raw milk? Do you have worries about it? Do you have questions? Get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then listen tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at noon, join us to celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Live from the Capitol Rotunda, it's Wisconsin's 42nd annual tribute and ceremony. With words and music, it's the nation's oldest official MLK State commemoration. Tune in Monday at noon here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org. Now, are you a worrier? Do you worry? Maybe a lot. Does it keep you awake or distract you? Could be something big and serious or something smaller that we get fixated on. Either way, worrying can be something to worry about. Help is on the way. Our next guest is a psychology expert who says we may not be able to stop worrying, but we can do it better, more productively, and in ways that give us less stress. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this a problem for you? When does worrying affect you the most? Have you found some solutions of your own? Hey, do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tracy Dennis-Tawari is an anxiety researcher and founder of Wise Therapeutics. She's a psychology and neuroscience professor at Hunter College in New York, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. She wrote about worrying in the Washington Post. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be with you.
Let's start with some of the basics. What really is worrying and how does it relate to anxiety?
Well, you can think of worry as the thinking part of anxiety. So it's the thoughts that go in, you know, through our head as we're feeling anxiety. It actually gives, in some ways, it gives focus to those anxious feelings because we sort of become mental time travelers into the future when we worry. We're imagining what might be coming around the bend. We're kind of doing this form of problem solving, really, where we're saying, ooh, what if this thing happens? What do we do? What are the bad outcomes that are possible? And what can we do to make the best outcomes come to be?
In that Washington Post piece, you share a personal example of something where, gosh, if I were you, I would have been worried too. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and how it inspired your ways to deal with worry?
Yes, that was when I was pregnant with my first child, my son, Covey. And we found out in the middle of my pregnancy that he was going to be born with a congenital heart condition that would require open heart surgery when he was, you know, would still be an infant. And so we knew this was reality. We knew that in that sense, my husband and I, that it was something out of our control. The diagnosis had been made. And so now worry was really my constant companion, because everything day to day was me thinking about, you know, what would happen when he's born? How can we prepare for this eventuality and any challenges we might face?
Now, stepping back from that for a bit, as you were saying earlier, worry can be good. It can serve some practical purposes. How can we tell when worrying is too much? When, whether it's a big problem like that or maybe something small that I've blown out of proportion, when do we see worry become a problem that we want to try to strategize about?
Right. I think that before we figure out whether it's a problem, we have to tune in to what worry is telling us. So like all difficult emotions, worry and anxiety, this is giving us information and preparation. So when I was worried, for example, about my son, his heart condition, of course, the information is that there's this potentially life-threatening situation. But in that information, I'm also projecting myself into a future where I know he can still survive and thrive. I know that it's not a death sentence necessarily, and so there's something I can do about it. And so now that anxiety and that worry is actually focusing me and preparing me to take steps now that I can, of what's in my control, and you know, some things are not in my control, but taking those steps to prepare for his birth, to do the research, find the right doctor. So, you know, this is uncomfortable. It's extremely distressing, and we've all experienced this firsthand. But when we can use that worry as information, you know, use it to problem solve and take steps in the future, you know, then it's still in this realm of healthy and normal worrying. And indeed, knowing that it's healthy allows us to really leverage it, you know, to take it as information and preparation. Now, to your question, when do we start to see that it is becoming a problem? One thing that can happen is that when we get so caught up in our worries, we start to worry about our worry. This is actually called meta-worry, where we fear that worry is so out of control, it's so overwhelming and constant that it's damaging to us or dangerous, and we won't be able to let go of it. And unfortunately, that fear of worry can actually spiral anxiety and worry even more out of control. So it becomes a vicious cycle. So if you find yourself having worries that seem to spiral and spiral and you're not sure how to let go of them, that can be a sign that worry is starting to get in your way.
Now, before we get into some worrying strategies, I don't want to leave our listeners worrying here. Your son, things came out pretty good, right?
Yeah, thank you. No, I wanted to make sure to put that in the story. I appreciate that. Yes, my son is now 14 years old. He did have open heart surgery when he was 4 months old, but we were so blessed. We had wonderful surgeons, wonderful healthcare providers, and now he loves doing things like playing the piano, running, wrestling, writing. And our doctors told us, you know, we don't have to worry about his health. We just have to, you know, get his regular checkup. So, I do want to say one thing quickly about that. Sometimes, because worry is sort of this attempt to predict and control the future, you know, we're trying to do anything we can to take care of ourselves and our loved ones. Of course, sometimes it doesn't work out. You know, someone wrote in to me with this article that they had a situation where they had a loved one where the story wasn't as happy as it was for my son. So, you know, I think when we think about whether worry is helpful or when it gets in our way, we do have to acknowledge that it gives us a sense of control, but there are things in life we can't control, and we just have to do our best to leverage worry to take whatever steps we can in this uncertain world we live in.
We're talking about worrying and how to work with our sense of worry with Tracy Dennis-Tawari, an anxiety researcher, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. Well, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a point in your life where you felt like you worried too much, where it was interfering with your daily life, your sleeping life? Did you find ways around that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's get into some of the advice you share in that piece. First of all, there are good steps to take. One of the steps, though, not to take, trying to avoid or block or stop worrying. That sounds like a good solution to me. Why is that not helpful, though?
Well, it's definitely what we feel primed to do, because worry has to feel unpleasant to do its job. It's painful. It has to grab our attention so that we focus on the future and take whatever preparatory steps we can. I mean, remember, anxiety, worry, these are feelings we evolved to have. And it is a double-edged sword, but like anything we try to suppress, you know, even anything as simple as don't think of a white bear. Of course, the first thing that's going to pop into our mind is a big picture of a white polar bear, probably. So anytime we try to suppress thoughts, especially when we try to suppress emotions, they always come back stronger than before. And there's good research to show this is the case. So if worry isn't going anywhere, if it's the human condition, and that if we can sometimes use it to our advantage, we do have to come up with solutions that aren't suppression and avoidance because they simply don't work. And so the first thing we need to do is to tune into our worries and allow ourselves to experience them so that we can start to see what information they're telling us.
And then that next step you have in your piece is, you know, I think of worrying all in my head. You say we want to locate the worry in our body.
And that's the best way to start tuning into it. So maybe, you know, I don't know if this ever happens to you, Rob, but I wake up sometimes at 4 a.m. with worries going through my head.
Oh, yeah.
And right? And that's and so, of course, what we want to do is make them go away. But here's an opportunity. But before we can really understand what this, maybe it's a swirl, kind of a miasma of thoughts in our head. We're not sure what we're even worrying about. Sometimes worry disconnects us from the feelings in our body because we get stuck in our head. So just taking time to pause. Maybe you are lying in bed worrying. You want to take a breath. You feel your heart beating faster. You start to tune into what are these feelings I'm having? Am I stiff? Am I holding myself tightly? Am I breathing rapidly? As soon as we start tuning in to those feelings, that the tension starts to unwind. We start to maybe realize that, oh, if I sit or I stretch or I just breathe, we practice riding those feelings, they start to dissipate. We also, when we give space to those feelings in our body, we often find that whatever we're worrying about, it kind of rises to the surface. So we start to realize, oh, this is the thought that's in my head. This is what's on my mind as I sort of have this yucky set of feelings that I'm trying to make sense of.
Anxiety researcher Tracy Dennis-Tawari is with us to help us manage our worrying about things big and small. She says we can't necessarily worry less, but we can worry better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Do you feel like you worry a lot? Does it get in the way of your daily life, keep you awake at night? Have you found some ways to take it head on, do something with it, get over it after you work with it a little bit? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll take the next steps on managing our worry coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with anxiety researcher Tracy Dennis-Tawari, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. She's sharing advice to help us manage our worrying. She wrote a piece about this in the Washington Post a few days back. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? If you're willing to share your story dealing with maybe chronic worrying or a point in your life where it was a problem for you, if you found ways to deal with it, if you have a question for our guest, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's pick up where we left off. Tracy, we've located the worry. We've seen how it's affecting us physically, the heartbeat, and so on. Your next step is to make worry concrete and contained. How do we do that?
Right. This is what some listeners may know of as name it to tame it. This is really about making our worries clear, giving them words. You know, often the worst part of worry is that we just have a jumble of thoughts and we're not sure what we're feeling. So just giving that time to, you know, treat yourself like a friend who needs you to lend them an ear. Really just allow your worries to come and don't judge them and don't push them away. Sometimes it really helps as you're sorting through any worries you might have. Pick a specific period of time to worry, especially if you feel like you're having a lot of worries. Write them all down. Give them words. But limit the time you're allowing yourself to worry. Say 15 minutes. You write down anything that comes into your head. describe the details of the worry, what you think are the bad things that could happen. Also, what are the good possibilities that you want to make happen? Picture what you're actually worrying about, not just worrying about, oh, I don't want this thing to happen. I don't want to, you know, I have this job interview coming up and I'm just feeling worried about it. No, actually picture, I'm worried that when I go into the job interview, I might not know what to say. Also, you could picture yourself actually solving that problem in the moment. So you just want to get very concrete. When I go to that job interview, I might have a moment when I don't know what to say, but then I'm going to remind myself of those two or three sentences that I memorized to start out the interview with. So here's where you can start to own these worries instead of letting them own you.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bevan is with us in Madison. Bevan, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say that in 30 years of Zen practice, also now today known as mindfulness, worrying is not something to be avoided or something you should feel bad about. It's actually a survival mechanism. And the point is not to avoid worrying, but to learn how to do it right. Because parents or anyone who worries properly will be worrying about the right things and how to basically manage that. So if you don't set aside time for worrying every day, and this is what a lot of meditation is spent in worrying, and then you get that done, and it's over with. So that's about it.
Bevan, thanks a lot for that call. And Tracy, that you had mentioned that the idea of scheduling worrying, does that work if it's 5 o'clock and I'm like having that worry and I'm like, no, I've got worry penciled in for 8 o'clock. Does that really help people?
It's amazing what usually happens for people. It does help many, many people. And what starts to happen when you give yourself this 15 minutes is you start to lose steam. You're like, oh, wait a second. you know, this worry that started feeling out of control, all of a sudden when you force yourself to worry for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, it loses its hold on you. And you've made these less frightening, these worries. You've made them concrete. And you've started to prime yourself, prepare yourself to come up with some solutions.
Bevan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And then you just mentioned solving the solutions we can come up with. How can we turn that sort of miasma of worrying into a problem-solving exercise?
Right. And really, this is the way we are approaching our worries. This is the way that we would approach any sort of problem solving in our lives. So it's, again, it normalizes. And as Bevan mentioned, you know, worry is a normal part of life. So rather than feeling that we're broken and worry is so damaging and destructive, really we can reframe our mindset to say, well, worry is a part of life, but I can use it to my advantage. I can gain skills in using it to problem solve. And so once you have tuned into your bodily feelings, you've tuned into your thoughts and given them words, you can start to problem solve in steps. So first you can start by brainstorming solutions. You know, all ideas are good ideas. Remembering that we do have to think about things that are in our control and maybe considering that some things are not in our control. Even in the case of my son, when he was diagnosed with a heart condition, that is out of my control that he had this condition. But what's in my control is that I can learn about the best doctors in my area. I can learn about what to expect and prepare kind of the ground, so to speak, for when he will be born. What do we need in place so that he can have the best outcome possible and the best support and health care? So brainstorm solutions that are in your control. Then, like any sort of brainstorm, evaluate the pros and cons. You can, type this up, take a pad and a sharp pencil, go through these steps with your worries. Take some time, think through the ideas, and then once you've evaluated pros and cons, you know, select one or two solutions that you can pursue. And then, staying concrete, make a solid plan to try out one or more of these solutions. And again, the more detail you write down, the better. With any problem solving, any habit changes that we might want to make, starting small, starting with doable steps one at a time, break it down into things that you can actually do. When my son was sick, I knew that I wanted to do everything I could to ensure that he was okay. And that's a big goal, so I broke that down into smaller goals. I started by finding the right doctor. I did some research on the condition. I learned, so I broke it down into these bite-sized pieces. I tried out some of these solutions, so that's the next step. Once we identify the plan and have doable steps, try out those solutions and then evaluate how does it work. And then from there, you can consider whether adjustments and additional problem solving is needed. So these worries that can be this miasma, this really unpleasant, overwhelming feeling, we're breaking that down into steps that we can actually take in our life.
We're talking about worrying with Tracy Dennis-Tawari, anxiety researcher, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hello.
Yeah, I wonder, it's a little bit like something my dad said a lot when he was alive, and he was a praying man, and he was not a fundamentalist type, but kind of devout, and he would say, okay, we'll pray now, and sometimes he'd even get on his knees and pray, which used to embarrass me, but it doesn't now. But he would say, okay, we'll lay these prayers out before the Lord, but he said, before we get up, we're going to take them all back.
Lay the fears out before the Lord and then take them back. Randy, thank you for sharing that. Tracy, I mean, whether we're writing it down on a piece of paper or meditating or praying, the same principle seems to apply.
I love that. And it just goes to show that, you know, we have these tools in our toolkit, whether it's faith, religious faith, whether it's health practice, whether it's journaling, whether it's just being able to find 5 or 10 minutes and sitting quietly. You know, these are things that we can do. And what I love about that suggestion of sort of laying it out is it's also acknowledging that there are some things we can control, there's some things we can't. There also has to be a level of acceptance. And, you know, the more you fight worries, the more they tend to accelerate and sort of feel out of control. And so there is a level here of accepting the messy work of being human. And so that's part of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Gina is with us in Appleton now. Gina, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask about, Gina, or bring up?
So just in listening to it, I just thought this was really interesting. I'm driving home after my day of work, and I've had a lifetime of, like, different levels of kind of worry that I've sorted through, and wondered, you know, is there a way to even really manage it? So it was really interesting to hear this today, because I might just pick up the book and
just
and
a
read
quick
that,
question, but, Gina, we're just about out of time.
Yeah. So what my question is there advocacy and kind of support for individuals that are, like, at a younger age, maybe?
Gotcha, teen. Gina. Thanks for the call. Tracy, we just have a minute or so left. Advice for helping young kids deal with worry.
I'd say all of these tools are the same, and kids especially, we can, you know, help them name it to tame it. We can help them give words to their worries, let them know that it's manageable, let them know that we're there to support them, and then help them let go, which is the final step, that once we've visited the future, made some plans, allowed ourselves to worry, we can come back to the present, and we can do that through prayer, through exercise, a journal, talking to a therapist, talking to a friend. We can also let go of these worries once we've used them as information and preparation.
Gina, thanks for the call. And Tracy, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was great speaking with you and your callers.
That was anxiety researcher Tracy Dennis-Tawari, author of the book Future Tense, Why Anxiety is Good for You, Even Though It Feels Bad. She joined us to help manage our worrying. There's still time for you to share your suggestions. Maybe you have advice, maybe a lesson you learned along the way on dealing with your worries and cares throughout your life. Let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org or post, share them on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, let's boost our happiness for 2023. We'll get started with a 7-day happiness project where a lot of different little things can add up to a big difference to hopefully make us a little bit happier in the new year. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to make some great salads with a self-described salad freak. We'll get some recipes and advice to make sure we never have another boring salad. I can use that. I love salads when somebody else makes them for me. I feel like I make really boring, uninteresting salads. So I'm looking forward to that. That and more coming up.